Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Good to have you with us, everybody. We're live worldwide. The evening edition of Close Up Radio Live. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm your host, Jim Masters. It is also a real pleasure and an honor to have an opportunity to chat with author extraordinaire Eve Carson. Now, we had an opportunity, actually, to meet Eve just a few weeks back when she came to our East Coast television studios in the New York area for Close Up Television, the television side of Close Up Television Radio. We had an extraordinary sit-down, on-set, in-studio conversation, which has been filmed and is being perfected as we speak. And I tell you, Eve Carson is somebody you want to have on your because she is tenacious, she is forthright, she is passionate and enthusiastic. As a matter of fact, she drove all the way to the East Coast from Indianapolis, Indiana, and then drove all the way back in a Pennsylvania blizzard to make her way back home, just to make sure that she was able to get to our studio for the sit-down extended conversation. That video will be available for viewing soon, as it's being worked on by our team in New York, editing and things of that nature. Well, I was so excited when I heard that we are continuing a series and kicking off a new series with Eve Carson, because her story is really one that's not only engaging and enthralling, it's inspiring as well. She's the author of the book Simple, Safe, and Secret, The 1981 Murder of Joan L. Webster. Eve seeks to keep alive the memory of her sister-in-law, Joan Webster, a Harvard student who perished in November of 1981 under very suspicious circumstances. And despite being a cold case and meeting resistance at every turn, Eve continues to seek justice for Joan. She investigated the investigator itself, the whole investigators, the investigation, everything. And that's where the problems lie, is she says it was a fabricated story. And verifiably false. Authorities even today have circled the wagons to cover the malfeasance, cover it up. And there are a lot of things that can contribute to authorities being involved. It is in this new two-part exclusive Close-Up Radio Live series, Eve will offer a more detailed perspective surrounding this decades-long cold case. And some of the material that Eve will discuss includes the cab driver at Logan Airport that saw Joan last alive, observations surrounding the Webster family, how the documents that she was able to acquire do not match up with the actual investigation. And she will then conclude with her views on how this case can and should be resolved. She says to be silent would make her complicit. Knowledge is very empowering and has been healing in some regards. Eve actively calls for justice even to this day. In fact, she is in the process of starting a nonprofit called Victims of Injustice Speak, V-O-I-S. So her mission is to solve this within her family, but also to inspire others who may be in similar situations who feel there's no answers and there will never be any answers. Well, Eve is somebody who's taken it on, and she's been really gung-ho about it, and it's really extraordinary. Let's welcome her back to Close Up Radio Live as we kick off this exclusive series together. Eve, welcome back to the program. It's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Good evening, Jim. It's so good to speak with you again, and delighted and to continue to share this story.
Absolutely, and it was a real pleasure to meet you in person at the television studio, and thanks for making that long, snowy drive back and forth. As I said, you are a real trooper, Eve.
You know, there are things that are worth it, and you make yourself available and do what you have to do.
Exactly right. Love to recap for our listeners in case they didn't hear previous conversations we've had on our series. Tell us about your mission and your purpose for joining us on the show today and in this new series.
Joan was halfway through her studies at the Harvard Graduate School of Design when she disappeared in November of 1981. Very unusual circumstances. She simply vanished, or at least that was the story that was presented. And it wasn't long before authorities came out with a theory. The theory compounded over the years and got increasingly sensational. It did get to a point where it's really hard to believe. Her remains were found 8.5 years later, so a very long period of time in between. And at that point, I had real doubts about what was being promoted. However, they still continue to promote it today. And I started to dig into the records when the former prosecutor decided to write a book about this and found such extraordinary inconsistencies that I needed to speak out.
And you really, again, have been so, you know, passionate about this, enthusiastic. As you've been here before, is there anything more specific that you would really like to discuss regarding this cold case?
One of the documents I recovered, and I recovered this from the current custodians of Joan's case, the Essex County District Attorney's Office in Massachusetts. So they have had this information all along. It was not information I knew at the time. For a long time, they explained that Joan simply vanished. No one really noticed her. But that was not true. Joan had engaged a cab at Logan and was preparing to go back to her dorm at Harvard when a man joined her by the cab. And the eyewitness description was really stunning because it did not match up at all with who the authorities were pursuing at that time and accusing of Joan's murder. That was a key piece of evidence, and that really is the focal point to try and really resolve answers and hold authorities accountable. Putting forward a false theory just to give someone to blame is not justice, and it can endanger others.
Yes, exactly, and that's something for people to recognize. I know, you know, the cab driver, eyewitness, the Webster family, all of these things still coming into play with this story, huh?
Absolutely. The eyewitness description described the man that was with Joan at Logan Airport. And physically, he was a much smaller man in stature than the man they were accusing, considerably smaller. He was a middle-aged white male, under 6 foot, about 160 pounds, and wearing an overcoat, which would suggest to me someone, a professional, perhaps. The man that they were accusing was over 6'2 and weighed about 200 pounds. He was a shell fisherman. He wouldn't have been dressed in professional clothes, certainly. The man that was with Joan actually got into a verbal exchange with the cabbie that Joan had engaged and decided that they did not want to take this cab. He turned to Joan. That, to me, showed familiarity. It showed me that Joan trusted this individual, and the two of them moved to a different car, and that's when Joan disappeared. That description, the composite that was derived from that, were completely suppressed. The authorities knew about it. It was the authorities that took that witness description. And I do have in police records that that description, that lead, was hand-delivered to the Websters. So So it was the Websters and the authorities who both then promoted the false story that had that information and ignored it.
You have, you know, you've for many years it was mistakenly alleged that Leonard Verdiso was the murderer. However, the cab driver, I guess, from your investigations, said that it was a different person. How is Leonard Verdiso different, physical and facial features, from the man that Joan met at Logan Airport in Boston?
Leonard Verdiso was a much larger man. There would be no way he could conceal that to present himself as a man much smaller in stature. Leonard Verdiso also didn't have the ability to drive a cab, as the authorities claimed. He was a parolee. He would not have been able to get a hack license. And actually, the car that Joan was moved to wasn't a typical cab, and it couldn't be identified by any cab numbers or call letters or anything like that. It was a blue vehicle, but it was in a restricted area that only livery or cab drivers would be able to enter. So it leaves open a very wide question mark of concern as to who was driving that second car and why was Joan moved to that second car. That's where she disappeared.
It's really something. It's like a Lifetime movie. I mean, just the extraordinary nature of it all, truly. Maybe you can also discuss George Webster's connection to the CIA.
It actually, both of Joan's parents, both Eleanor and George, had been in the CIA in the early 1950s. They never discussed what they did with the agency, but that's actually where they met. They were there for a few years before moving to Dayton, Ohio, where Joan was born, where George worked for his father. Shortly thereafter, he moved back to the East Coast area in New Jersey, where he went to work for ITT, ironically, in the telecommunications division, which became a covert company for the CIA during the Chitelco, which is something that many people might not be familiar with, but it was during the Watergate era. And there were several CIA connections. Chairman of the board was a former CIA individual. And George Webster was in some pretty precarious positions. But actually, both George and Eleanor had been in the CIA.
Okay. That is the spin to the whole thing. You know, being such a powerful person within the CIA, from your perspective, Eve, why do you feel maybe he didn't use all the resources at his disposal to find justice for his daughter?
That's a very concerning question, and one that I've certainly raised a number of times. He did have the connections. He even had the connections in Boston. They had the means. They had the influence. And certainly with connections to an organization like the CIA, if a family member had been harmed, you would pull out every stop to try and find the culprit and find justice. At the time, I assumed they were working with a qualified group of individuals with law enforcement. The FBI was involved with the case. I found that none of them were pursuing a real justice in this case. And he had the ability to do so. So it raises very great concerns for me, because as a family member, I learned that I was deceived. They were not telling me the truth, whether secretive or telling me things that were blatantly false. That's very concerning. You know, as I said, knowledge is very empowering, but in this case, it's also very frightening.
Yes, absolutely. What are the controversies surrounding Eleanor Webster that you have found through your digging deep?
Eleanor Webster was a very interesting individual. She was very insecure. She was an illegitimate child, which in her era would have been a very shaming thing, and she carried that with her. It was very identifiable. She really wanted to be somebody, and she was very money motivated. I know that after George's father passed away, Eleanor was very angry that she had not been named specifically in Reginald Webster's will, which I found very unsettling, unsavory. I just really thought that was rather tacky, to put it bluntly. But though she had had a lot of loss in her life, killed in the Korean War, her father, who did marry her mother but then divorced when Eleanor was a young girl, he was no longer a part of her life in any way. Her mother remarried, and the second father adopted her, but then he passed away. So she had a lot of loss. And I think to Eleanor, she wanted to hold on to the one thing she had, which was George Webster and the image that she had.
Yeah, that's, you know, keeping that image, keeping everything sort of swept under the rug. How did all of this play into the family dynamic of a sort of a family dysfunction?
Family was very dysfunctional. It's a patriarchal family. George Webster always had the attitude that what he said was what everyone was to believe and abide by. And Joan's siblings today are very much that way. So they went along with the story. They went along with the theory that was being presented out there. To this day, that continues. You know, it's just a very unusual set of circumstances with this family. I know that as a mother and someone raising my children, they were always interfering, overriding me at times that were totally inappropriate. But they had their own way, their own desire of how things should look, and not necessarily how things should be. And my experiences with them over the 25 years I was married to Joan's brother really brought a lot of that to light, although not in ways that I could fully understand until the latter years of our marriage.
Yeah. You were in a tough spot, too, through it all, I'm sure. What were Joan's siblings like, Steve and Anne?
Again, both of them very insecure. Anne was kind of a technical type, on the quieter side. She ended up divorcing her. So, you know, another family member who had raised some concerns in the family, he was gone. And I think that's more or less what happened to me. I feel a little bit like collateral damage with the Jones circumstances, because I was the only non-blood relative who was part of the immediate family during all of this. If anyone was to be able to really get to the answers and get to the documents as I have, I posed a threat to the Websters, especially to Joan's brother. There was something that I learned really only about a year ago, that Joan's cousin, a first cousin, actually is a convicted sex offender. And the mother, Eleanor Webster's sister, was also reported to the police for her inappropriate behaviors, signs, symptoms, behaviors with children. And ironically, it's very similar to the allegations that I discovered made against Joan's brother, Steve. So they're still trying to cover up the ugly business that's in their closet.
You were married to Steve for 25 years.
Yeah.
What was he like? And during that time, did you have any suspicions? Were you uneasy? Or was it just a normal, loving relationship? What was he like, and what was the marriage itself like during those many years invested, 25?
From my standpoint, I genuinely loved him and wanted to be a good wife, good mother, good daughter-in-law. And I think my blood kin relatives would tell you that that's exactly the type of person that I am. There were odd behaviors, but I couldn't really pinpoint, you know, what seemed so out of place. Steve would always try to get attention. He always kind of wanted to entertain. He would grab dinner checks. He always wanted people to like him. And it was really unusual. There were times when both of us would be asked if either one of us had been to a certain location or been to see a certain show or been to a certain restaurant. If he had been there, then he counted that as both of us have having been there, as if his experiences counted for my own experience, which it doesn't. I happen to be a very independent thinker, so there were times that we hit friction. We did try to, you know, work with a family counselor. They noticed right away that Steve was very focused on image management as opposed to really addressing the concerns and the questions, because there were behaviors. You know, I don't want to air dirty laundry, but there were signs there that if I had understood really what was going on, and if I had understood that the family hadn't been truthful to me all these years through other experiences with the family, it would have raised a red flag much sooner.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Are there any other relatives, immediate or extended, that you would like to discuss on this episode?
Yeah. Joan's cousin, his name is John Reed, and he is a convicted sex offender. He's on a sex registry. He abused children, and there were four counts that had been sent to me by his ex-wife. So there are other victims there that could probably been prevented. Webster's never mentioned one word about this kind of embarrassing set of circumstances and very concerning set of circumstances within the family itself. And the mother was also reported to the police at that same time. So Eleanor and her sister were very much alike. They went through the same experience, you know, with loss. I know that there was resentment, considering they kind of portrayed it as they were abandoned by their father. I don't believe that that was really the case, but I know that the father actually would schedule a visit with a friend where he could watch his grandchildren at a play date without them knowing who he was, just so he could see his grandchildren. Very sad.
Yeah, it really does sound like it is. I would imagine with all of this, and you and I talked about this in the television video interview, you fear for your daughters?
Absolutely. I know that question gets posed to me a lot, but allegations that I brought forward to the Essex County District Attorney's Office, they blatantly ignored them. And these weren't hearsay allegations. This was in a written letter making allegations against Joan's brother, Steve. Very frightening. And, you know, I can't prove them to be true or false, but it is certainly something that should be investigated. And considering all the other pieces that I've learned since then, I do have great concern that those allegations were absolutely true. If that's the case, then there still are secrets that the family is trying to hide. And that puts my daughters in a very vulnerable position. If they're trusting Webster family members who've not been truthful about a murder in the family, that's concerning. And when asked the question, I very often now put back the question of, what would you do if you found out a member of your family had lied to you about a murdered member of the family? It's horrifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely right. It really is extraordinary. I know that coming up next week, we're going to be talking about fraudulent investigation and the resolution, and we're going to be sharing some clips and things of that nature as well, which is going to be extraordinary. And folks, we're talking to the author of Simple, Safe, and Secret, the 1981 murder of Joan L. Webster. Eve is here, Eve Carson, the author, as she seeks to keep alive the memory of her sister-in-law, Joan Webster, as I mentioned at the top, Harvard student who perished in November of 1981 under very suspicious circumstances. And despite being a cold case and meeting resistance at every turn, Eve has not given up to seek justice for her sister-in-law, Joan. Eve is going to be back with us next week. That'll be Wednesday evening, March 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific Live for part two of the series. And there are a couple of different places you can go. You can go to genesisbookpublishing.com. And, of course, look for Simple, Safe, Secret. And also her website, justiceforjoanwebster.com. That's justiceforjoanwebster.com. And the book also available at Amazon, Eve?
Yes, it's available. Yeah. Wherever you can buy books online for certain Genius Books, also you can get it through them. There's a link on my website, which is actually set up very much like a blog where I can actually show documents and kind of give the whole sequence of events so people can follow and begin to understand the case. What was a very sensational case, Jim, for so many years, it really boils down to something very simple. This was the cover-up, and it's a cover-up still today.
And we will uncover more next week on part two of our series with author Eve Carson. Eve, thanks for joining us on the show. Always a pleasure. And again, it was a pleasure meeting you at the television studio for the interview and now returning to Delving Deeper on Close Up Radio Live. Appreciate you, and we will look forward to meeting at the same time, same bat channel, next week on Close Up Radio Live. Thanks for joining us tonight, Eve.
Thank you, Jim. You have a good evening.
You too. You take care. A very special guest, author Eve Carson, joining us. I'm your host, Jim Masters, thanking you for your time. This time till next time, and inviting you to stay right there. More great episodes of Close Up Radio Live coming up in just a moment, 24/7, 365. Just for you. For all of us, have a terrific day. Come see us again, and thanks for joining us. Bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.